And here are your hosts, Shanae and Katrina.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 4 of The Bookies. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning, Shanae.
How are you today?
I'm good. Yourself?
Actually, I'm a little bit stressed today.
Why? What has you stressed?
Well, I hopped up and went into the bathroom and there was this friggin' huntsman spider on the wall. Now, for all people who know, huntsman's like as big as your hand.
Yep.
And I'm thinking the only way that spider could get in is through my bedroom window, because you know when the window's closed, the seals lock, but when you open it, they can climb through one side and through the other.
Yes.
And the only thing between my bedroom window and the bathroom is me.
And they're scary little buggers, aren't they?
Oh, but I'm thinking, did it climb over me? Did it climb around me? So now I'm left wondering, like,
with one eye open, huh?
Now I'm thinking, God, I might have to move to another room to sleep.
You know what? It's pretty daunting. I'm like that, and then I wonder, and then when at night time I look around and I see if I can see anything, and then it makes me really paranoid.
You know what? The first thing I do every morning,
what?
After I clean my teeth, I go out to the lounge room and I'll search the walls. To make sure there's no, because they always hang up on the walls.
Yes, they do.
And like, I am so paranoid with spiders. I've had so many problems or experiences with spiders that they freak me out.
Yep, especially the huntsmen, because they are big. Like, they're not the small little ones. They're so big. And I know that we're bigger, but they feel like they're bigger than us.
You know what? I have 5 cans of Mortine spread around the house.
Overload.
No, wherever I am, I can grab a can and spray that little bugger. And I know some people will say, oh, why don't you catch it and put it outside?
Because they're too big and scary.
The only spider for me is a dead spider.
Fair enough.
So that's why I'm a little bit stressed, because my eyes are always flicking around just waiting to see if one's going to pop out from somewhere. So anyway, you missed yesterday's interview with David.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. I was really looking forward to that interview as well. How did that go?
Good. And guess what? He knows James Blunt.
There you go. You've got your foot in the door already.
The door has slightly cracked.
Yep.
So, he knows him from a few years ago. And I says, any chance of saying, picking up the phone and saying, hey, want to do me a favour? That might be pushing it. So, but hey, I'm still closer. I've got that one friend now, so I'm happy.
One connection is better than no connections. So you're almost there.
Well, that's it. Now, the interview with David, he had some fantastic news about he wants to do a trailer for his series, A Time to Kill.
Right.
And what he's done, he's rewritten his 3 books and combined it into one.
Oh, okay.
He says, oh, it's a massive 150K. And I said to him, David, I said, most of my books are 150K. But I just found it interesting that he found it a struggle to put 150K down, where I have to get mine from 200K down to 150K. But he's kickstarting. Crowdfunding was what we discussed the week before about the publisher. He's kickstarting to get enough money to do a trailer to promote his book into a sellable tool to market to producers to do into a movie.
Wow.
So that will be interesting and crowd-breaking, just like when I wrote the song, torch song to the Love Mentalist. That had never been done. Now he's doing an actual trailer, a one-hour trailer to sell to others from writing from his books. So that's another avenue.
It's a different avenue, isn't it? Yeah, it's very different.
Yeah, so I think he's asking for $100,000, but hopefully he'll get it and he'll do it.
Good luck to him. I hope he does.
Yeah, as I said, it's another avenue to do it. And I'm thinking, good marketing tool as well.
Yeah, Yeah, I guess your mind ticking, doesn't it, when you look at the way other people approach things.
Yeah, so anyway, we had 96 listeners on our first podcast.
Oh, wow, congratulations to us.
I know. I mean, our family loves us.
Now we need our family to go and market for us to everyone else.
I must remind everybody they can only listen once because it only takes once. Okay. 8 out of those 96 were our family. So the other 88 were from around the world, from South Africa, England to Canada, quite a few in the US. And I've actually had some feedback. Love the fun. It's just not boring interviews. You and Katrina have a really good connection. And she's the sane one. You're the crazy one.
Yeah, that sums it up.
I felt like saying she's the diplomat. One actually said, it worries me that I don't know whether you could be a really close friend or someone to be very scared of.
Both. Trust me.
And then I thought, okay, I'm going to take that as a win. Because just because I speak my mind, I always speak for good, never for evil.
That's true.
So, we've had a few people write in and ask us questions that will apply to certain interviews that we did. Like there was a few there about publishing, which I asked Karen about.
Right.
That I will ask Karen about coming up. So, and, so the interaction is working. But you know what? Most of these come from Facebook, not from Twitter.
I believe that because Facebook is more of an interactive sort of avenue. Like the platform is designed for that. Twitter is in real time, but it doesn't get the same sort of publicity surrounding tweets. It's sort of, yeah, it's very, very different.
Yeah, so I was quite surprised and I had a lot of people offering to come on as to be interviewed.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Mm.
I look, totally agree with you on that. But we can't take everybody and we're trying to do a diverse section of all different genres.
Mm.
So we do have JD coming up. As I said, he'll be on our next podcast. No, the next podcast we have an agent and then the following podcast after that is JD.
Wow, looking forward to that. You've spoken so highly of him. I'm really looking forward to listen to what he has to say.
You just want to get the dirt on me.
That's just a bonus.
And I told him to be brutally honest and, you know, hopefully he'll be so in the interview. But the agent that's coming up on our next episode, she actually tells us the differences that when they see a query or they receive a query, what they actually look for before they respond to the author querying.
That's interesting. That's a little bit of insight for all authors and anybody who's starting out or somebody that is wondering how their manuscripts get picked up or what they're looking for. That'd be good for them to sort of give them a guide.
Well, that's true. And the other thing that she sort of said to me was that they always reply to every query.
And that's courteous. That's courteous. And that's what a lot of companies lack.
Well, that's right. I mean, as I said to you, I did 101 queries and got 8 replies, but not one of them just said to me, you know, what was wrong, what I needed to work on, why they didn't pick it up.
Mm.
So one lady said I was head hopping.
Yeah.
But, and I understand that. That's how it goes. But you know what? I'm writing one scene now where I've just it just fits that internal thought in like two paragraphs. Like it just fits, and I'm trying to sneak it in and I'll see what it is.
Okay.
But the funny thing is, like I have mentioned this, that better readers are fantastic for their opinion on how they take the book in and what they feel is needs to be fixed or what they like or what they don't like. And 3 out of the 5 said that they didn't mind the internal dialogue because it actually is what happens.
You know what? That is true, Shanae. And honestly, just listening, like, you know, in all of our years that we've been on Twitter, social media, that we've marketed our books or we've supported each other in writing, I think that better readers are your first point of contact because in ideally, they're going to be the ones that are going to pick up your book from the shelves. So I think ideally, having the better readers read the book first and foremost, that'll give you an indication of what you can strengthen, what you need to weaken, what you need to drop completely before you go to the manuscript stage of sending it off to publishers. I think that way it gives you an indication from the public first. And then once you get to the publisher, you've got those little polishes. And I'm not saying that publishers are automatically going to pick you up or pick your work up, but it is an indication of what the reader is looking for, whether you're on the right track or how you can change things if need be.
Well, that's true. And you know what? They say get an alpha first.
Yes.
But I'm past that.
Yes, we know this.
No, but it's good for new writers, like to pick up plot holes and things like that. I am past that because I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
So, but the one thing I wanted that's been big on Facebook this week is that trigger. Do our books need trigger warnings?
Explain that. What do you mean by trigger warnings?
Well, one woman was explaining that romance books should have a trigger warning of whether there's any cheating in the book. And
why cheating?
Because that sets her off.
Oh, okay, I see.
And then another one says, oh, okay, yeah, well, you know, spousal abuse, you know, blah, 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 sets me off. But the thing is that I was being a romance writer, I sort of sat back and thought about this for a while before I replied. And I said, are we going to come to a stage where we're going to have a warning label on every single book we write, like on the back of a jar of that you buy from the supermarket,
ingredients,
of ingredients. Mm. And I said, surely readers are savvy enough to pick up in the blurb
where the book's headed, what is going to happen in the book.
That's right.
I mean, I'd understand if it was coarse language. I think that is because, you know, that is not, we have that on warnings when it comes to TV shows. Or explicit sex scenes, or if it's going to be, you know, if it's going to be like, what is that, hardcore sex scenes with whips and all that kind of stuff. I'd understand if we needed warnings for things like that, but not for every little category. Otherwise, we'd have two or three pages just on warning signs.
Well, that's right, because I said to her, I said, quite often leaves rustling in the wind or ocean, a breeze, like anything could set my PTSD off.
It's true. It could. Anything. It can be just even just a word. It could be even a scene set. Anything could. You can't predict what's going to set somebody else off.
And you know what she said to me? She wrote, she reposted, I would only give you one star if that was the case, if your book set me off. And
I said, oh my goodness.
And I said, well, that's an unfair review, and it actually, I don't deserve it just because there was one little thing in there that you didn't like.
And what did she say?
She said, doesn't matter. And I said, well, why buy the book in the first place?
That's right.
I tell you now, don't buy First Wife's Reprisal because that's going to set you up.
I mean, you're right. If you read the back of the book, it gives you an indication of what the book is actually about. It gives you an indication of which avenue the book is going down. So therefore, if you are the type of person that you know something is going to set you off, or you know that you don't like certain scenes or scenarios, I'm a bit like that where it comes to certain things, some things that I will not read. I look in the back of the book, and that gives me an indication whether I'm going to be traumatized by a book or not, or by the scenes or things like that are going to affect me emotionally. I wouldn't buy the book. I wouldn't read the book, because I certainly would think it would be unfair to give a one-star review just based on the fact that I couldn't relate to the book or I found the book traumatizing.
Well, it's a biased review.
Yeah, I think so.
But it makes me wonder if all these people who receive 1- and 2-star reviews.
Yeah, I just think the same thing. Yeah, I know where you're going with this. Yeah.
Yeah, whether they actually should have that 1- or 2-star review because this one person didn't like that type of book. Like, I was sent a book to read by somebody and said, what do you think of this? Now, yeah, it was sci-fi, which is definitely not my genre, and I just saw no market for it whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I said, look, I don't really want to comment on it. I said, because this isn't my genre, and I don't know whether this is what people read or this is what people are looking for. So I would suggest you send it up, ask for better readers on who write fantasy or sci-fi to do it. She got very upset because I wouldn't give her my opinion. But I didn't think it was fair for me to give her my opinion because I don't read that stuff, and I would never buy it in a bookstore or rate her for it.
I think you're being very fair in that aspect, but some people can't see it from that point of view. And they really can't, because they can't understand or comprehend that not everybody reads every single genre. Some of it just doesn't suit us. Some of it just doesn't appeal to us. And so I think it's really unfair to read something that you generally wouldn't read to give it a bad review, because you're setting the person up who's written it for a fall.
Well, that's exactly right. There's a difference between romance and contemporary romance and women's fiction.
That's right, yeah.
And I call it modern romance, what happens in today's world.
Right.
And in today's world, unfortunately, those things happen.
They do, yes. It's relatable.
Exactly right. So I just sort of thought it was unfair. And if this is how readers' perspectives go, then why bother reviewing and leaving a one star at all?
I agree, and that's not fair to the author. It's not fair to, it isn't, if you've already, you're right, it is a biased review, and if you're already set them up for that fall, because let's face it, as authors, we do rely on reviews, and it's not just us as readers. I don't anymore as much as I used to, but we do rely on reviews before we buy a product, before we read a book. We do rely on them. Other people rely on them. Now that I'm on the other end of the scale, I don't necessarily rely on them as much as I used to, because I know how reviewers can be biased and how they cannot be productive. But generally, because people rely so much on them, they're looking at a one-star review and they're going to assume that the work isn't for them, but it very much could be, and they might feel very differently.
Yeah, but what it gets me with this one person is that she kept putting it out there. So this one person...
Yeah,
is trying to gather momentum to get more people to agree with her.
Yeah.
And it only takes one person, you know, to burst a balloon. But just the way that she just keeps going and going and reposts it in different ways and, you know, things like this. If she was in my forum, she'd be kicked out by now.
Yeah, I can imagine. But you know what? I think that a lot of people who post their opinions, I think when they post their opinions, they are looking for, like, you know, that support in numbers, that what they're thinking and feeling to be correct. I think a lot, especially these days with so much social media, validation comes to mind. They want to know that their opinion or their concept is validated in some way.
But don't you think it's just another troll voicing their opinion instead of typing their opinion?
Yeah, I think so. But people don't, they aren't quick to pick that up because they think, well, this person's is only their opinion. They're not realizing the criticism or the harshness, or, you know, if they're just reading that and they think, well, she's got a point, they don't see how much it actually is really trolling just in a diplomatic way.
That's right. And I just sort of said, look, it's freedom of speech of the writer. They write about what is happening around them, their environment, their surroundings, their memories from childhood, all those different things. And it's the writer's right to put in their story what they want. Just
that's
because
right.
it affects you doesn't mean it affects the other 10 billion people in the world.
That's right.
I mean, and you know what she said? Oh, you're going to sell 10 billion books, are you? I said, oh, my God, you're missing my point entirely. Goodbye.
People like that aggravate me because I think they start off with a point that they're trying to express, but they're not prepared to take the healthy criticism with it. And then when they are caught out on the criticism, they respond in such a childlike manner. It's a very childlike way. There is
and dogmatic.
Yes.
You know, those people set me off. But, you know, I have restrained myself.
I can imagine.
You know, and I sort of see this stuff. And, look, I do have to let it pass. But, like, when you start attacking those sort of things like that I write about, you're turning off other readers of other romance books, not just me, but other people who write romance books, just because of something that might affect you.
Yeah.
So, but she's started a thing on about all books should have warning labels or warning at the beginning of their books. And David actually, when I spoke to him yesterday, he actually has a warning in his book because some of the scenes are explicit horror, bloodied, scenes.
Yeah, well, so that I understand. Like I said, we have warning signs on for the general stuff, like, you know, like on, like we do on TV. We have the what are they called? This is M captions or whatever it is. So, yeah, I understand having it on in general, but I don't understand and I don't know how it would work if you had to put a warning on every little thing, because, again, it would come down to 2 pages just on warning labels in some books.
Well, that's exactly right. So, but anyway, let's move on to our guest. Well, Katrina had to leave us, and I'll be doing the interview with our special guest, Karen Duplessis, who will explain the ins and outs of the publishing world. She is an editor and a fine one at that. I've sent her an invitation to join us today. What she has to say will blow your mind about the ways you go about getting your book to market, and you'll be very surprised to hear what she has to say. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome. Now, we met on Facebook, which I've come to find is a really good instrument for swapping ideas, and it's more interactive than what Twitter is, actually.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and I've just set up a few different, I've got 4 profiles on there now. And I know, it's just blows my mind. And what drew my attention was your insights into the publishing. Now, there's 4 types of publishing. We've got traditional publishing, self-publishing, vanity hybrid publishing, and small press indie publishing. And today we're going to discuss the pros and cons of each one. So let's start off with traditional publishing.
So traditional publishing is the one that carries the most prestige. It's incredibly difficult to get published by a traditional publisher. It's difficult. Most of the publishers, including the big 5, only accept manuscripts via agents. So you have to first get a literary agent to represent you. Then they shop around your manuscript and try to get a publishing deal. And because it's so difficult, there is a certain level of prestige that and bragging rights that go with that. But there is also a big downside to that that a lot of people don't realize. They think, oh, you know, this publishing house is going to cover all the costs. I don't have to worry about editing or covers or formatting or typesetting. And that is true. That is taken care of by the publishing house. But firstly, a lot of authors underestimate how long it will actually take to see the book in print. Because from the time you sign a contract with a traditional publisher, you're looking at a year to 18 months for your book to actually appear in print or on bookshelves somewhere. The process is very long. It goes through multiple rounds of editing. There's all sorts of meetings about the cover design. It's just a very long, drawn-out process. People also, most importantly, underestimate the money that you're going to earn.
That's correct.
A lot of people... You see like all these celebrities that are getting these 6-figure advances, and you think, oh, you know, if I can get published by a traditional publisher, yeah, I'm going to make loads of money. And that's not at all the case. These days, unless you're a celebrity or a big name author, advances are very small. If you're a first time author, you'll usually get an advance of between $3,000 and $10,000. I've got a few traditionally published clients, and they are earning around $7,000 a book. And I don't know if you followed the Big 5 merger court case. Where,
no, we didn't hear about that here in little old Aussie.
It's a big topic of discussion at the moment because there was a blogger who posted all the statistics that were released during that court case. But basically, they released during this court case, it was to see if Penguin Random House would get a monopoly if they bought out Simon & Schuster, and they released a whole lot of quite shocking statistics. And one of those statistics was that 80% of authors will never, ever earn out their advance. So that means if you get...
I was going to say, so if they get $7,000, that's it, and they'll probably still owe the publisher.
Yeah, so you get $7,000, and that is all the money you will ever see. You will never, ever earn any more than that. And when I look at those clients of mine who are traditionally published compared to the ones who are self-publishing, I have a couple of clients that are earning around $30,000 a month. And, you know, it seems like, even though there is more outlay when you are self-publishing, because obviously you've got to pay to get the editing done yourself, you've got to pay for covers yourself, but there is more potential to earn money, definitely, self-publishing rather than traditional publishing.
Okay, let's just go back and finish off traditional publishing. So traditional publishing, you get the advance, but they have a say in the cover.
Yes.
They have a say in your writing, like if they want something changed, you have to do it.
Yes.
You're selling them something that they can change or alter to make it more profitable for them.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Because they think that, obviously they have an idea about what will sell, and so they want to make sure that your book fits that. So they might ask you to change certain plot points. They will, although generally they do ask for input on the cover, but if you absolutely hate your cover and they think that's the cover that will sell, that's the cover that they will go for. There's very little control that you have on those aspects. I do find that the smaller publishing houses are usually a bit more flexible. They're more collaborative.
Okay.
If you're with one of the major publishers, you're a small fish in a big pond.
All right. Now, self-publishing, let's hit that one.
Okay. So self-publishing, basically the authors themselves are responsible for creating the finished product. You're responsible for publishing it. You're responsible for marketing it. You bear all of the costs, but you keep all of the profits. There are authors who will just edit the book themselves. They'll use things like Grammarly. I don't recommend that. And even making the covers, unless you have some sort of graphic design type of experience or talent. My sister-in-law has self-published and she's a photographer, and she did a fantastic job on the covers because she is a photographer and she knows Photoshop inside out and she's good at design sort of stuff. But if you're not that way inclined, the best option obviously is to outsource the cover and the editing, the different programs that you can use to format. So you'll have to bear those costs. But once you actually have your book out there and published, if you are strategic about your marketing, there is potential to do really well. So the earning potential is better than traditionally published authors. That author that I mentioned, yeah.
And you start, and you basically start earning money as soon as you publish. So it's probably a month between you finish, polish, put it together that you actually start getting royalties.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. And the author that I mentioned that is there's one in particular that's making around $30,000 a month. She does spend probably in the region of about $5,000 in advertising a month, which obviously she's built up over time. It didn't start out like that. But if you're willing to put in the work and learn how to market effectively, there is massive earning potential.
And
there are lots of very helpful groups on Facebook.
And how many books has she published to get to that 30,000?
I think she's probably got about 40 out now.
How many?
It is built up about 40.
Okay, so
I've got a few clients that are earning quite big, and I'm trying to remember who published what.
Okay,
but yeah.
Right. So now we go on to vanity publishing.
Yeah. So vanity publishing is sort of a cross between the two in a way, in that you get one company to do all the things for you, the editing, the formatting, they organize the covers. But with vanity publishing, you have to pay them. They sometimes like to call it assisted publishing, where they don't obviously pay you any advance like traditional publishers do. And there is sort of a cost sharing with the author where the author will have to pay for things like editing the cover and a bit of marketing. It just depends on what contract you have with the vanity publisher. Contracts will differ slightly.
Okay, so basically,
and then they take your royalty as well.
So basically it's the same as self-publishing, except because you're paying for the editing, you're paying for the cover, and they get more royalties than what you do.
Yes. Okay. You usually only get a small percentage of the royalties. And the amounts that you have to pay are generally quite high. Like they'll say, it costs $6,000. Or if the costs are lower, they'll say to you, okay, it costs $1,000, but you have to pay, as part of your agreement, you have to buy 200 copies of your book or whatever it is. People just have to be very careful. Yes, absolutely.
So check the fine print on everything, and also the length of the contract of how long they own your book. And also,
yes, absolutely.
The other thing is, I've discovered this, is that you must also have a clause in there that if they go under, then the rights revert back to you.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Otherwise, because if you don't have that, once they've gone under, you won't be able to publish that book yourself.
That's right.
So, yes, absolutely.
Okay. A lot of people don't realise that they need these different little clauses in there. Like we're going to be talking about small press indie publishing now, which is who is published my book, The Last Page, and also picked up the Love Mentalist series. And
yes.
I found them wonderful. But in the contracts, it was like a bit of going backwards and forwards. And the main thing that I kept control of, because in one of the books we have a torch song, and this is what we've been talking about, Harry James Blunt, we want to record this song. But I own all rights to that song, and they make nothing out of that song. Anything to do with that is totally mine. So, and I also put in a, if it ever came a TV series or a movie or anything like that, then it's all mine. They have no right or rights to it at all. But the other thing I like about with them is that I have a say in the cover. I also, they do all the editing, and they go back, and they're very good at it. There's a lot of communication, and even though it is sort of like a vanity contract where you're paying it off with your royalties, at the end of the day, they do all the work for you, but they also do some of the marketing, not all. I mean, in all the whole four we're talking about, you've still got to do your own marketing.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So go on.
I think these small indie presses are actually, if you are the type of person who feels a bit overwhelmed by the thought of having to organize an editor and then organize a cover designer and then format everything, it actually is a great option. Obviously, the agreements change depending on who the small press is. But as you explained, you can actually negotiate things. So you could negotiate, okay, you're just giving them the rights for the ebook and the print in English, but you are keeping all the translation rights, you are keeping any film rights that or any adaptations or whatever that come. So you can negotiate things with small presses, and generally because they're small presses, they are more collaborative and things. They will get your input on different things. A lot of them work is they don't pay any advance like the traditional publishers. They won't pay you in advance. They will solely make their money off a percentage of the royalties. That is how they make their money. So you don't get any advance. They're getting their money through some of the royalties. But they generally provide much better quality covers and editing than you would find at vanity publishers. Even though you're paying this exorbitant amount at vanity publishers, generally their editing is subpar. Their covers are not great. So these small indie presses are actually a great option for authors that are a little bit unsure.
Yeah, I can't speak highly enough of Edit Tingle, who I'm with, and the collaboration between us has been wonderful. And like the first cover they brought out for my book, I said, no, I don't like it. And they said, oh, well, this is what the market is asking for. I says, no, it's too childish. I said,
okay, yeah.
Yeah, like it was more of a rom-com type of book where it wasn't a romance, but I didn't want that bare-chested man or, you know, I didn't want that.
Yes, yes.
So we sort of collaborated on it, and it was good. They were wonderful about it. So in the end, we settled, and I was happy, they were happy. And again, they have done marketing for me, but also you've got to do a lot of your own as well.
Yeah, but even with traditional publishers, that is what you have to do, because in your contract, they will give you a marketing budget. But when you are an unknown author, you get a tiny, tiny budget. They are not spending the same amount of money in marketing on Prince Harry or Jeanette McCurdy than they are on you. So,
but you know what?
They might do.
I think this is a problem that a lot of the new writers think that they have, that they, and you've seen this on Facebook as much as I have, that they think they're going to become rich overnight.
Yes.
And it's not that, it's a lot of hard work. And I mean, I don't believe that people will start making money unless they're, as I've said before, a diamond in the rough, until they bring out their third or fourth book and they start getting a following.
Yes. I mean, traditionally to find a huge level of success as if you're traditionally published, is those people are outliers. That is absolutely not the norm. So people shouldn't go into traditional publishing thinking, I'm going to make so much money, because that's just not the case. There's, tiny budgets for marketing. They might arrange some like book signings for you at a few bookstores. And yes, they do have a large distribution network, so your book will get into a lot more bookstores. But that doesn't necessarily mean the book's actually going to sell. You still have to get your name out there. You still have to be posting on social media and, doing all these things to get people to actually see your book. Because obviously if they don't know exists, they're not going to buy it.
Okay, so at the end of the day, and this is why I actually developed Authors Queries, was authors to help other authors by bringing in their readers for other authors to help market their book. So it's basically the authors joining together to help promote each other.
Absolutely, yes. I think it's a fantastic idea because, you can not only share audiences but also share your expertise and, experiences with other authors. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, and it's just on the – I keep going back to Authors Queries, which isn't what this is about today. But we just introduced a new notice board and research group. And what that does is, when you're looking for something, like I was looking for something in New York, like the Lyric Theatre, the photo show columns, and I didn't know whether they were wooden or whether they were brass or some sort of metal. So I posted on there, and a guy replied. He says that they're wooden, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh, great, if somebody lives in an area or has seen what you're writing about and you can't get the finer details, then authors can actually answer the questions for you. Saves you hours. I mean, I've been searching for months on this, and this guy answered like three of my questions in like 5 minutes, where it's taken me months to do it. So, but it's also like for editors and better readers and other authors to help you along your writing journey. So that was important. And I don't allow book promoters in there. It is basically author and author. We do have editors in there, but there is no selling of services. It's specifically an author's research group and notice board to ask for help.
I think that's a fantastic idea. I love it.
Thank you. And I've actually hooked that back to the website. So you can only get an invitation to that notice group to sign up through the website, and then we'll invite you to come on into the group because there's we've got a huge marketing campaign next month with Katrina's the only one who knows the actual what I'm developing, and it blew her mind. She says, oh, my God, she says, where is this been? So I'm not at liberty to say yet. But that's going to be a big thing, and we hope that everybody will come on board and join the authors directory, put all your links, all your everything in one place, like your Facebook, your Twitter, your TikTok, your website, your blog, your bio, your books and all that, all in one place, so people can look you up and, they don't have to follow you on Twitter, follow you on Facebook, follow you on TikTok. It's all there in the one spot.
Sounds fantastic.
Hopefully it is. It's been many years. We actually ran out of money there for a little while, and we had to sort of stop, which was quite embarrassing. But we found the money, and we sort of kept going and kept going. But we're there now. But the publishing market, thank you for explaining it. There's a lot of myths, a lot of hearsay, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about what is the best way. And at the end of the day, again, it's going to be the author who decides what road they travel down.
But yes, absolutely.
what I've done is, yes, I do have a publisher, and I am bringing out First Wife's Reprisal. I'm self-publishing that. And people say, well, why are you self-publishing that when you've already got a publisher? And the reason is that publishers have more than one client. And
yes,
and you know, they have like 30 or 40 other authors they have to worry about. Now, I tend to write 3 or 4 books a year, and I can't expect them to concentrate solely on me. So I'm actually self-publishing a few, so that way I can actually bring out 2 or 3 books a year rather than wait 18 months for one book. So
yes,
and that's what people have to realise, that self-publishing might be instant. Traditional, you do have that little bit more notice.
There is a bit of a waiting period, yeah.
Yeah, well, there is 18 months, and it is like a little bit, oh, well, I've got one of the big fives. But that now, the publishing industry is sort of coming apart in different areas because of all these other influences, and it's going to come down to the agents as well. I mean, we've got an agent coming on soon. That's why with the how authors queries, like, you can query agents on there as well, because that is also changing as well with the advancement of technology. So now, if anyone who hasn't listened to episode 2 of the Bookies, and you'll hear the story I had with 3 different agents of different ages, and they reflect on how they work. And that was a really, really interesting discussion. I actually sat back and let them hash it out. But but it was interesting how the different age groups, like someone who is 60 and has been in the industry for 40 years to someone who is in their 20s, who is brought up with technology and a more savvy way of working with technology. And it was interesting to hear what they had to say. So, but anyway, Karen.
And
the
publishing industry changes fast.
Oh, it does.
It changes fast.
And the thing with Amazon too, that's all changing as well.
But we just
have to stay one step ahead of them. So thank you for being with us and explaining all that to us. Now, Karen, give us your contact details if anybody wants to hire you as an editor.
You'll find probably the easiest way to contact me is via my Facebook page. I've got a Facebook page called KD Editing, and that's probably the quickest way to get hold of me, because I check that regularly.
Yeah, oh, don't we all? You know, I avoided Facebook for years and years and years, and now I'm on there, as I said, with the Bookies podcast, my personal author's account, and 2 of author's queries, and a 3rd one coming up. And I'm going to need a personal assistant
to keep track.
Just to keep up, because it's not leaving me any time for writing. So, but it's funny how those things, I'm giving up my time to help other authors, and I do it all for free. But I was given the gift of a mentor, and it showed me that there are good people out there who are willing to help other authors. And this is just sort of like paying it forward. Anyway, thank you for joining us. And
thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we'll see you on the next episode of The Bookies. Bye.
Join Shanae and Katrina next week for another fun-filled, informative episode of The Bookies.